Robo-debt is now the notorious byword for the debacle that can occur when government decision-making is automated and left without proper human oversight. But there were plenty of indications this week that the lessons of robo-debt still haven't been learned in Australia. A new Commonwealth Ombudsman report found that the Department of Workplace Relations didn't act fairly or reasonably in its approach to compensation for people whose income support was unlawfully cancelled. The report says unsuccessful job seekers continue to be stigmatised in Australia, even though those 650,000 Australians are unlikely to find ongoing employment no matter how hard they try. And on Thursday, Sydney University hosted the inaugural Carney Public Lecture, named after Emeritus Professor Terry Carney, who was a member of the Administrative Appeals Tribunal, ruled on no less than five occasions that the robo-debt scheme was illegal. The inaugural Carney Lecture was given by none other than Terry Carney himself. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Professor Carney to Sunday Extra.
Lovely to chat with you.
Terry, your address was titled Australian Social Services Scandals, plural. Now, robo-debt is the most notorious one, but what are the other scandals that you spoke about?
I talk about four of them. They are each somewhat different, which is the point, except that they all impact very adversely on vulnerable social security recipients. So the other three, first of all, the one that you've already alluded to, and that's for people of workforce age, it's the system of suspensions or loss of payments that apply to people who are unemployed and who are working with private employment providers in a what is often a fairly fruitless attempt to render them competitive in the labour market. Hundreds of thousands of suspensions of payments made under the targeted compliance framework, with a smaller number losing payment permanently. With suspensions, once a person complies, the payment is restored, both in this most recent report by the Ombudsman on the scheme and in the previous report. The point was strongly made that people who are living on the margins, any interruption, 4 weeks or so of non-payment under the suspension period, affects all of the things that are critical to your livelihood, your ability to pay rent, your ability to put food on the table, your ability to look after your kids, and so on. So that's the first one, the targeted compliance framework. There was also a smaller but equally significant mistake made in the way that employment income was allocated. It's called the apportionment scandal, and it was unlawful. The way in which a person who had casual fluctuating income and so only worked on some days in a pay fortnight, the way in which those days of payment were allocated to the social security payment, which often overlapped two payment periods. And the way that the scheme works is that your income from the government, your social security payment, is adjusted in accordance with how much income you've got in the particular fortnight. The result was that there were under and overpayments of people. And the final one is in relation to the NDIS and the way from the middle of 2026, people's budgets, the amount of money that a person under the scheme has to meet their needs, is going to be calculated.
I mentioned the Ombudsman report this week about the targeted compliance framework. It seems from that that even when errors were made, the government's been responding to its errors in a way which is very unuser-friendly and therefore presumably reduces the chances that people who've already suffered one wrong will actually get recompense for it. Is that what the Ombudsman found?
Yeah, the latest report dealt with three things, and the first of which was how well the department responded to the first report of the Ombudsman earlier this year. What the earlier report found was two very unlawful things in the scheme. The first was that it was terminating people's payments contrary to a law that the department itself had introduced, and they totally failed to program that into the software that the department operates. And the other thing that they'd not done for 3 years, Parliament had passed a law that the department had sponsored that there should be a digital protection framework to ensure the people who were vulnerable didn't suffer adverse consequences. What the department did in response to the unlawful aspects that had been found in the first Ombudsman's report was simply say, these people can apply under a discretionary scheme of the finance department, but in actuality, it's a scheme that rarely leads to any compensation being paid to an applicant. What the Ombudsman had recommended in the first report was that there should be a scheme that of compensation simply provided to all the people that the department dealt with unlawfully.
Yes, I think you described it as like dealing with a grasshopper plague by knocking off individual locusts with a child's pop gun.
That was actually in response to deficiencies in the response to the Robodebt Royal Commission. One of the things that was really stunning out of Robodebt, but doesn't get much attention, is that only one in every 2,000 people who had an unlawful robo-debt actually got to the door of the tribunal that was able to deal with their individual grievance. Now, the government accepted the Royal Commission's recommendations that in addition to correcting the injustice to the individual, if there's a systemic issue, as this clearly was in relation to robo-debt, you know, more than 500,000 people were in the same boat of being confronted with these unlawful debts. If the tribunal finds a systemic issue, they can now refer it to departments and other bodies for rectification. The difficulty is that if only one in every 2,000 cases get to the door of the tribunal, and you couple that with the fact that most of these scandals involve automation, the speed and numbers of people impacted is extraordinary. I mean, in robo-debt, it went from 20,000 a year to 20,000 a week. So the problem with the grasshopper plague analogy is that it's going to take a while before enough grasshoppers hit the windscreen of the person driving to realise that, well, actually, maybe we should stop and do something about cleaning the windscreen before we have a major accident kind of thing. It's just too slow and inappropriate to deal with systemic problems like the four that I talked about in my address.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with the giver of the inaugural Carney Public Lecture, Terry Carney. In your address, Terry, you did say that individual grievance pathways have been rebuilt post-robo-debt to a high standard, which sounds encouraging. Could you tell us what's been done on that front?
Yes. Well, all the recommendations that the Royal Commission made to ensure that individual justice is provided have been enacted. The most important of those was to prevent the system being gamed. Back in robo-debt days, because the first level of hearing at the tribunal is private, in robo-debt, when I made my five rulings that the scheme was unlawful, the government just said, we'll accept those five cases, but the other 500,000 or so, we're not going to change anything. Now, those decisions can and would be made public by the tribunal in an anonymised form. That's the first thing. The second thing that's been done is to say, when something that affects a number of people in the same way is identified by the tribunal, it can, and indeed has already, publicly refers that issue to the secretary of the head of the relevant department. And that referral is made public in the annual report of the tribunal, and the action that is taken or not taken and how long it takes the department to deal with the referral is also required to be made public.
So you've mentioned a mechanism for dealing with systemic problems, but it's also those systemic harms that you argue are still inadequately addressed, and you referred in particular to delegating that targeted compliance framework to the entrepreneurial employees of for-profit employment providers. Could you explain those delegations and the challenges that they pose?
Yes, once upon a time, and probably for many of your listeners, they still think of Social Security and most government services as being delivered by public servants. That isn't the case at all in relation to people of workforce age. Everything that matters to the person who is unemployed is entrusted to an employment provider, most are now for-profit, organisation that operates in the way any business operates in accordance with what is good for the survival and profitability of this employment service business. The main sanction for people who are thought not to be doing the right thing when they're in contact with their case manager at an employment service is to suspend their payment because they're quote-unquote not meeting their mutual obligations. And they're quite extensive, not just looking for work these days, but turning up for interviews, doing things that many people think are quite meaningless and, frankly, often outside observers like myself would say are just going through the motions.
And how often do the private providers get those calls about suspension right, Terry?
Yeah, this is one of the really interesting things from the Ombudsman's latest report. The Department of Employment and Workplace Relations' own data said that of the suspensions actioned by the employment service, there's no public servant who considers and endorses their suspension. So how many of them do they get wrong? 6 out of 10. Well, actually just fractionally higher, 61% of them are wrong. Why are they wrong? Principally because of the difference between the logic of running a business or being an employee of a business and being a public servant. One of the other findings that the Ombudsman has made and put in bold in the report is that in so many of these cases, there's no documentation of who the person is who is being suspended, what it is that they've done wrong or supposedly have done wrong, and so on. Why are 6 out of 10 of those suspensions later overturned? Because new information comes to light. In other words, the kind of information that if it was in the hands of the public service would have been collected at the very outset.
And I think this is where you had another colourful analogy, Terry, because you described the challenge as being the equivalent of renovating a decrepit property while still living in an intolerable structure, which is not an appealing prospect. But what do you think can and should be done?
Yes, well, I mean, advocates in the welfare sector, and you know, I well understand their positions. They're on the public record of saying we should just wind up mutual obligation, we should terminate all the contracts that have been let to these millions and millions of dollars of contracts between the government and private sector agencies to provide employment services, and we should do that tomorrow. There's something that lawyers call sovereign risk, as well as the law of contracts, that says, well, actually, it's not possible to do that responsibly as a government. You'd want to make sure there was a system in place of what you'd close down. So what I say is that I agree with the recommendations of a parliamentary committee 2 or 3 years ago, the Hill report, or more recently, the report by Deloitte into the targeted compliance framework. And both of them said, and the Deloitte report actually laid down the timetable for doing it. They said over a period of not more than 2 years, one should transition from a scheme which is all about beating the unemployed around with sticks, sanctions-based approaches, whereas quite a lot of the rest of the world has moved on to using incentives, nudges, supports, etc., as a way of encouraging the kind of behaviour that you want to see in relation to employment and getting people prepared to be back in work. Ironically, the Department of Social Services has already done that in another crucial sector in relation to what used to be called welfare fraud, and it has been hugely successful because, as in the fraud context, it's one or a fraction of a percent of people who are doing the wrong thing. And similarly, as the Ombudsman has made clear in relation to the compliance framework, you know, of the 600,000 people or whatever it is that are in that scheme, the vast, vast majority are trying to do the right thing. And, you know, any mistakes that appear to be leading to a basis for suspension because you've not met your mutual obligation or other expectations is not due to any fault on your part. And so, as the rest of the world has found, it's a lot cheaper for government and more effective in terms of social policy to be doing as other countries in the world have repositioned the architecture of how you go about dealing with people of workforce age who are on social security.
And just finally, Terry Carney, I wanted to ask you about the institution of the inaugural Carney public lecture. Does this indicate that you will be giving an annual public lecture for the rest of your days?
No, the great thing about it is that, you know, that it can only get better. I mean, I was stunned when I was approached to admit this lecture to be named after me. So
I don't suppose you could have said no to giving one, though.
No. Fortunately, the one and only time that people were bored was last Thursday night when I gave the inaugural one. From then on, as I say, it can only get better. They can get people who have more interesting things to say.
Well, it's been great to hear your interesting things on Sunday Extra. Professor Terry Carney, thanks so much for joining us.
Your pleasure.
That's Emeritus Professor Terry Carney, who this week gave the inaugural Carney Public Lecture.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.